the real control, to remain in the dark, so that personally he can never be brought to account for his actions. For under such circumstances, none of the decisions taken, no matter how disastrous they may turn out for the nation as a whole, can be laid at the door of the individual whom everybody knows to be the evil genius responsible for the whole affair. All responsibility is shifted to the shoulders of the party as a whole. In practice, no actual responsibility remains, for responsibility arises only from personal duty, and not from the obligations that rest with a parliamentary assembly of empty talkers. The parliamentary institution attracts people of the badger type, who do not like the open light. No upright man who is ready to accept personal responsibility for his acts will be attracted to such an institution. That is the reason why this brand of democracy has become a tool in the hand of that race which, because of the inner purposes it wishes to attain, must shun the open light, as it has always done and always will do. Only a Jew can praise an institution which is corrupt and false as himself. As a contrast to this kind of democracy, we have the German democracy, which is a true democracy. For here the leader is freely chosen and is obliged to accept full responsibility for all his actions and omissions. The problems to be dealt with are not put to the vote of the majority, but they are decided upon by the individual. And as a guarantee of responsibility for those decisions, he pledges all he has in the world, and even his life. The objection may be raised here that under such conditions it would be very difficult to find a man who would be ready to devote himself to so fateful a task. The answer to that objection is as follows. We thank God that the inner spirit of our German democracy will of itself prevent the chance careerist, who may be intellectually worthless and a moral twister, from coming by devious ways to a position in which he may govern his fellow citizens. The fear of undertaking such far-reaching responsibilities under German democracy will scare off the ignorant and the feckless. But should it happen that such a person might creep in surreptitiously, it will be easy enough to identify him and apostrophize him ruthlessly, somewhat thus: "Be off, you scoundrel! Don't soil these steps with your feet, because these are the steps that lead to the portals of the pantheon of history. And they are not meant for place-hunters, but for men of noble character." Such were the views I formed after 2 years of attendance at the sessions of the Viennese Parliament. Then I went there no more.
File 21.
The parliamentary regime became one of the causes why the strength of the Habsburg state steadily declined during the last years of its existence. The more the predominance of the German element was whittled away through parliamentary procedure, the more prominent became the system of playing off one of the various constituent nationalities against the other. In the imperial parliament, it was always the German element that suffered through the system, which meant that the results were detrimental to the empire as a whole. For at the close of the century, even the most simple-minded people could recognize that the cohesive forces within the dual monarchy no longer sufficed to counterbalance the separatist tendencies of the provincial nationalities. On the contrary, the measures which the state adopted for its own maintenance became more and more mean-spirited, and in a like degree the general disrespect for the state increased. Not only Hungary, but also the various Slav provinces, gradually ceased to identify themselves with the monarchy which embraced them all, and accordingly they did not feel its weakness as in any way detrimental to themselves. They rather welcomed those manifestations of senile decay. They looked forward to the final dissolution of the state, and not to its recovery. The complete collapse was still forestalled in Parliament by the humiliating concessions that were made to every kind of importunate demands at the cost of the German element. Throughout the country, the defence of the state rested on playing off the various nationalities against one another. But the general trend of this development was directed against the Germans. Especially since the right of succession to the throne conferred certain influence on the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the policy of increasing the power of the Czechs was carried out systematically from the upper grades of the administration down to the lower. With all the means at his command, the heir to the dual monarchy personally furthered the policy that aimed at eliminating the influence of the German element, or at least he acted as protector of that policy. By the use of state officials as tools, purely German districts were gradually but decisively brought within the danger zone of the mixed languages. Even in Lower Austria, this process began to make headway with a constantly increasing tempo, and Vienna was looked upon by the Czechs as their biggest city. In the family circle of this new Habsburger, the Czech language was favoured. The wife of the Archduke had formerly been a Czech countess, and was wedded to the prince by a morganatic marriage. She came from an environment where hostility to the Germans had been traditional. The leading idea in the mind of the Archduke was to establish a Slav state in Central Europe, which was to be constructed on a purely Catholic basis, so as to serve as a bulwark against Orthodox Russia. As had happened often in Habsburg history, religion was thus exploited to serve a purely political policy, and in this case a fatal policy, at least as far as German interests were concerned. The result was lamentable in many respects. Neither the House of Habsburg nor the Catholic Church received the reward which they expected. Habsburg lost the throne, and the Church lost a great state. By employing religious motives in the service of politics, a spirit was aroused which the instigators of that policy had never thought possible. From the attempt to exterminate Germanism in the old monarchy by every available means, arose the pan-German movement in Austria as a response. In the 80s of the last century, Manchester liberalism, which was Jewish in its fundamental ideas, had reached the zenith of its influence in the dual monarchy, or had already passed that point. The reaction which set in did not arise from social, but from nationalistic tendencies, as was always the case in the old Austria. The instinct of self-preservation drove the German element to defend itself energetically. Economic considerations only slowly began to gain an important influence, but they were of secondary concern. But of the general political chaos, two-party organizations emerged. The one was more of a national, and the other more of a social character. But both were highly interesting and instructive for the future. After the War of 1866, which had resulted in the humiliation of Austria, the House of Habsburg contemplated a revanche on the battlefield. Only the tragic end of the Emperor Maximilian of Mexico prevented a still closer collaboration with France. The chief blame for Maximilian's disastrous expedition was attributed to Napoleon III, and the fact that the Frenchman left him in the lurch aroused a general feeling of indignation. Yet the Habsburgs were still lying in wait for their opportunity. If the War of 1870-71 had not been such a singular triumph, the Viennese court might have chanced the game of blood in order to get its revenge for Sadowa. But when the first reports arrived from the Franco-German battlefield, which, though true, seemed miraculous and almost incredible, the most wise of all monarchs recognized that the moment was inopportune and tried to accept the unfavorable situation with as good a grace as possible. The heroic conflict of those 2 years, 1870-71, produced a still greater miracle, for with the Habsburgs the change of attitude never came from an inner heartfelt urge, but only from the pressure of circumstances. The German people of the East Mark, however, were entranced by the triumphant glory of the newly established German Empire, and were profoundly moved when they saw the dream of their fathers resurgent in a magnificent reality. For, let us make no mistake about it, the true German-Austrian realized from this time onward that Königgrätz was the tragic though necessary precondition for the re-establishment of an empire which should no longer be burdened with the palsy of the old alliance, and which indeed had no share in that morbid decay. Above all, the German-Austrian had come to feel in the very depths of his own being that the historical mission of the House of Habsburg had come to an end, and that the new empire could choose only an emperor who was of heroic mould, and was therefore worthy to wear the crown of the Rhine. It was right and just that destiny should be praised for having chosen a scion of that house which Frederick the Great had, in past times, given the nation an elevated and resplendent symbol for all time to come. After the Great War of 1870-71, the House of Habsburg set to work with all its determination to exterminate the dangerous German element, about whose inner feelings and attitude there could be no doubt. Slowly, but deliberately. I use the word exterminate because that alone expresses what must have been the final result of the Slavophile policy. Then it was that the fire of rebellion blazed up among the people whose extermination had been decreed. That fire was such as had never been witnessed in modern German history. For the first time, nationalists and patriots were transformed into rebels. Not rebels against the nation or the state, as such, but rebels against that form of government which they were convinced would inevitably bring about the ruin of their own people. For the first time in modern history, the traditional dynastic patriotism and national love of fatherland and people were in open conflict. It was to the merit of the pan-German movement in Austria during the closing decade of the last century that it pointed out clearly and unequivocally that a state is entitled to demand respect and protection for its authority only when such authority is administered in accordance with the interests of the nation, or at least not in a manner detrimental to those interests. The authority of the state can never be an end in itself, for if that were so, any kind of tyranny would be inviolable and sacred. If a government uses the instruments of power in its hands for the purpose of leading a people to ruin, then rebellion is not only the right, but also the duty of every individual citizen. The question of whether and when such a situation exists cannot be answered by theoretical dissertations, but only by the exercise of force, and it is success that decides the issue. Every government, even though it may be the worst possible, and even though it may have betrayed the nation's trust in thousands of ways, will claim that its duty is to uphold the authority of the state. Its adversaries, who are fighting for national self-preservation, must use the same weapons which the government uses, if they are to prevail against such a rule and secure their own freedom and independence. Therefore, the conflict will not be fought out with legal means, as long as the power which is to be overthrown uses them. But the insurgents will not hesitate to apply illegal means if the oppressor himself employs them.
File 22.
Generally speaking, we must not forget that the highest aim of human existence is not the maintenance of a state of government, but rather the conservation of the race. If the race is in danger of being oppressed, or even exterminated, the question of legality is only of secondary importance. The established power may, in such a case, employ only those means which are recognized as legal. Yet the instinct of self-preservation on the part of the oppressed will always justify, to the highest degree, the employment of all possible resources. Only on the recognition of this principle was it possible for those struggles to be carried through, of which history furnishes magnificent examples in abundance, against foreign bondage or oppression at home. Human rights are above the rights of the state. But if a people be defeated in the struggle for its human rights, this means that its weight has proved too light in the scale of destiny to have the luck of being able to endure in this terrestrial world. The world is not there to be possessed by the faint-hearted races. Austria affords a very clear and striking example of how easy it is for tyranny to hide its head under the cloak of what is called legality. The legal exercise of power in the Habsburg state was then based on the anti-German attitude of the Parliament with its non-German majorities, and on the dynastic house, which was also hostile to the German element. The whole authority of the state was incorporated in these two factors. To attempt to alter the lot of the German element through these two factors would have been senseless. Those who advised the legal way as the only possible way, and also obedience to the state authority, could offer no resistance, because a policy of resistance could not have been put into effect through legal measures. To follow the advice of the legalist councillors would have meant the inevitable ruin of the German element within the monarchy, and this disaster would not have taken long to come. The German element has actually been saved only because the state as such collapsed. The spectacle theorist would have given his life for his doctrine rather than for his people. Because man has made laws, he subsequently comes to think that he exists for the sake of the laws. A great service rendered by the Pan-German movement was that it abolished all such nonsense, though the doctrinaire theorists and other fetish worshippers were shocked. When the Habsburgs attempted to come to close quarters with the German element by the employment of all the means of attack which they had at their command, the Pan-German party hit out ruthlessly against the illustrious dynasty. This party was the first to probe into and expose the corrupt condition of the state, and in doing so they opened the eyes of hundreds of thousands. To have liberated the high ideal of love for one's country from the embrace of this deplorable dynasty was one of the great services rendered by the Pan-Germanic movement. When that party first made its appearance, it secured a large following. Indeed, the movement threatened to become almost an avalanche. But the first successes were not maintained. At the time I came to Vienna, the Pan-German party had been eclipsed by the Christian Socialist Party, which had come into power in the meantime. Indeed, the Pan-German party had sunk to a level of almost complete insignificance. The rise and decline of the Pan-German movement on the one hand, and the marvellous progress of the Christian Socialist Party on the other, became a classic object of study for me, and as such they played an important part in the development of my own views. When I came to Vienna, all my sympathies were exclusively with the Pan-German movement. I was just as much impressed by the fact that they had the courage to shout, "Heil Hohenzollern!" as I rejoiced at their determination to consider themselves an integral part of the German Empire, from which they were separated only provisionally. They never missed an opportunity to explain their attitude in public, which raised my enthusiasm and confidence. To avow one's principles publicly on every problem that concerned Germanism, and never to make any compromises, seemed to me the only way of saving our people. What I could not understand was how this movement broke down so soon after such a magnificent start. And it was no less incomprehensible that the Christian Socialists should gain such tremendous power within such a short time. They had just reached the pinnacle of their popularity. When I began to compare those two movements, fate placed before me the best means of understanding the causes of this puzzling problem. The action of fate, in this case, was hastened by my own straitened circumstances. I shall begin my analysis with an account of the two men who must be regarded as the founders and leaders of the two movements. These were George von Schönerer and Dr. Karl Lueger. As far as personality goes, both were far above the level and stature of the so-called parliamentary figures. They lived lives of immaculate and irreproachable probity, amidst the miasma of all-round political corruption. Personally, I first liked the pan-German representative, Schönerer, and it was only afterwards and gradually that I felt an equal liking for the Christian Socialist leader. When I compared their respective abilities, Schönerer seemed to me a better and more profound thinker on fundamental problems. He foresaw the inevitable downfall of the Austrian state more clearly and accurately than anyone else. If this warning in regard to the Habsburg Empire had been heeded in Germany, the disastrous World War, which involved Germany against the whole of Europe, would never have taken place. But though Schönerer succeeded in penetrating to the essentials of a problem, he was very often much mistaken in his judgment of men. And herein lay Dr. Luger's special talent. He had a rare gift of insight into human nature, and he was very careful not to take men as something better than they were in reality. He based his plans on the practical possibilities which human life offered him, whereas Schönerer had only little discrimination in that respect. All ideas that this pan-German had were right in the abstract, but he did not have the forcefulness or understanding necessary to put his ideas across to the broad masses. He was not able to formulate them so that they could be easily grasped by the masses, whose powers of comprehension are limited, and will always remain so. Therefore, all Schönerer's knowledge was only the wisdom of a prophet, and he never could succeed in having it put into practice. This lack of insight into human nature led him to form a wrong estimate of the forces behind certain movements and the inherent strength of old institutions. Schönerer indeed realized that the problems he had to deal with were in the nature of a Weltanschauung, but he did not understand that only the broad masses of a nation can make such convictions prevail, which are almost of a religious nature. Unfortunately, he understood only very imperfectly how feeble is the fighting spirit of the so-called bourgeoisie. That weakness is due to their business interests, which individuals are too much afraid of risking, and which therefore deter them from taking action. And, generally speaking, a Weltanschauung can have no prospect of success unless the broad masses declare themselves ready to act as its standard-bearers and to fight on its behalf wherever and to whatever extent that may be necessary. This failure to understand the importance of the lower strata of the population resulted in a very inadequate concept of the social problem. In all this, Dr. Luger was the opposite of Schönerer. His profound knowledge of human nature enabled him to form a correct estimate of the various social forces, and it saved him from underrating the power of existing institutions. And it was perhaps this very quality which enabled him to utilize those institutions as a means to serve the purposes of his policy. He saw only too clearly that, in our epoch, the political fighting power of the upper classes is quite insignificant, and not at all capable of fighting for a great new movement until the triumph of that movement be secured. Thus he devoted the greatest part of his political activity to the task of winning over those sections of the population whose existence was in danger, and fostering the militant spirit in them rather than attempting to paralyze it. He was also quick to adopt all available means for winning the support of long-established institutions so as to be able to derive the greatest possible advantage for his movement from those old sources of power. Thus it was. First of all, he chose as the social basis of his new party that middle class which was threatened with extinction. In this way, he secured a solid following which was willing to make great sacrifices and had good fighting stamina. His extremely wise attitude towards the Catholic Church rapidly won over the younger clergy in such large numbers that the old clerical party was forced to retire from the field of action, or else, which was the wiser course, to join the new party in the hope of gradually winning back one position after another. But it would be a serious injustice to the man if we were to regard this as his essential characteristic, for he possessed the qualities of an able tactician and had the true genius of a great reformer. But all these were limited by his exact perception of the possibilities at hand, and also of his own capabilities. The aims which this really eminent man decided to pursue were intensely practical. He wished to conquer Vienna, the heart of the monarchy. It was from Vienna that the last pulses of life beat through the diseased and worn-out body of the decrepit empire. If the heart could be made healthier, the other parts of the body were bound to revive. That idea was correct in principle, but the time within which it could be applied in practice was strictly limited, and that was the man's weak point. His achievements as burgomaster of the city of Vienna are immortal in the best sense of the word, but all that could not save the monarchy. It came too late. His rival, Schönerer, saw this more clearly. What Dr. Luger undertook to put into practice turned out marvellously successful, but the results which he expected to follow these achievements did not come. Schönerer did not attain the ends he had proposed to himself, but his fears were realized, alas, in a terrible fashion. Thus, both these men failed to attain their further objective. Luger could not save Austria, and Schönerer could not prevent the downfall of the German people in Austria.
File 23.
To study the causes of failure in the case of these two parties is to learn a lesson that is highly instructive for our own epoch. This is especially useful for my friends, because in many points the circumstances of our own day are similar to those of that time. Therefore, such a lesson may help us to guard against the mistakes which brought one of those movements to an end and rendered the other barren of results. In my opinion, the wreck of the pan-German movement in Austria must be attributed to three causes. The first of these consisted in the fact that the leaders did not have a clear concept of the importance of the social problem, particularly for a new movement which had an essentially revolutionary character. Schönerer and his followers directed their attention principally to the bourgeois classes. For that reason, their movement was bound to turn out mediocre and tame. The German bourgeoisie, especially in its upper circles, is pacifist even to the point of complete self-abnegation, though the individual may not be aware of this, wherever the internal affairs of the nation or state are concerned. In good times, which in this case means times of good government, Such a psychological attitude makes this social layer extraordinarily valuable to the state. But when there is a bad government, such a quality has a destructive effect. In order to assure the possibility of carrying through a really strenuous struggle, the Pan-German movement should have devoted its efforts to winning over the masses. The failure to do this left the movement from the very beginning without the elementary impulse which such a wave needs if it is not to ebb within a short while. In failing to see the truth of this principle clearly at the very outset of the movement, and in neglecting to put it into practice, the new party made an initial mistake which could not possibly be rectified afterwards. For the numerous moderate bourgeois elements admitted into the movements increasingly determined its internal orientation, and thus forestalled all further prospects of gaining any appreciable support among the masses of the people. Under such conditions, such a movement could not get beyond mere discussion and criticism. Quasi-religious faith and the spirit of sacrifice were not to be found in the movement any more. Their place was taken by the effort towards positive collaboration, which in this case meant the acknowledgement of the existing state of affairs, gradually whittling away the rough corners of the questions in dispute, and ending up with the making of a dishonourable peace. Such was the fate of the Pan-German movement, because at the start the leaders did not realize that the most important condition of success was that they should recruit their following from the broad masses of the people. The movement thus became bourgeois and respectable, and radical only in moderation. From this failure resulted the second cause of its rapid decline. The position of the Germans in Austria was already desperate when Pan-Germanism arose. Year after year, Parliament was being used more and more as an instrument for the gradual extinction of the German-Austrian population. The only hope for any 11th-hour effort to save it lay in the overthrow of the parliamentary system. But there was very little prospect of this happening. Therewith, the Pan-German movement was confronted with a question of primary importance. To overthrow the Parliament, should the Pan-Germanists have entered it to undermine it from within, as the current phrase was, or should they have assailed the institution as such from the outside? They entered the Parliament and came out defeated, but they had found themselves obliged to enter. For in order to wage an effective war against such a power from the outside, indomitable courage and a ready spirit of sacrifice were necessary weapons. In such cases, the bull must be seized by the horns. Furious drives may bring the assailant to the ground again and again, but if he has a stout heart, he will stand up, even though some bones may be broken, and only after a long and tough struggle will he achieve his triumph. New champions are attracted to a cause by the appeal of great sacrifices made for its sake, until that indomitable spirit is finally crowned with success. For such a result, however, the children of the people from the great masses are necessary. They alone have the requisite determination and tenacity to fight a sanguinary issue through to the end. But the Pan-German movement did not have these broad masses as its champions, and so no other means of solution could be tried out except that of entering Parliament. It would be a mistake to think that this decision resulted from a long series of internal hesitations of a moral kind, or that it was the outcome of careful calculation. No, they did not even think of another solution. Those who participated in this blunder were actuated by general considerations and vague notions as to what would be the significance and effect of taking part in such a special way in that institution which they had condemned on principle. In general, they hoped that they would thus have the means of expounding their cause to the great masses of the people, because they would be able to speak before the forum of the whole nation. Also, it seemed reasonable to believe that by attacking the evil in the root, they would be more effective than if the attack came from outside. They believed that if protected by the immunity of Parliament, the position of the individual protagonists would be strengthened, and that thus the force of their attacks would be enhanced. In reality, everything turned out quite otherwise. The forum before which the Pan-German representatives spoke had not grown greater, but had actually become smaller, for each spoke only to the circle that was ready to listen to him, or could read the report of his speech in the newspapers. But the greater forum of immediate listeners is not the parliamentary auditorium. It is the large public meeting. For here alone will there be thousands of men who have come simply to hear what a speaker has to say, whereas in the parliamentary sittings only a few hundred are present, and for the most part these are there only to earn their daily allowance for attendance, and not be enlightened by the wisdom of one or other of the representatives of the people. The most important consideration is that the same public is always present, and that this public does not wish to learn anything new, because, setting aside the question of its intelligence, it lacks even that modest quantum of willpower which is necessary for the effort of learning. Not one of the representatives of the people will pay homage to a superior truth and devote himself to its service. No, not one of these gentry will act thus, except he has grounds for hoping that by such a conversion he may be able to retain the representation of his constituency in the coming legislature. Therefore, only when it becomes quite clear that the old party is likely to have a bad time of it at the forthcoming elections, only then will those models of manly virtue set out in search of a new party, or a new policy which may have better electoral prospects. But of course, this change of position will be accompanied by a veritable deluge of high moral motives to justify it. And thus, it always happens that when an existing party has incurred such general disfavour among the public that it is threatened with the probability of a crushing defeat, then a great migration commences. The parliamentary rats leave the party ship. All this happens not because the individuals in the case have become better informed on the questions at issue, and have resolved to act accordingly. These changes of front are evidence only of that gift of clairvoyance which warns the parliamentary flea at the right moment, and enables him to hop into another warm party bed. To speak before such a forum signifies casting pearls before certain animals. Verily, it does not repay the pains taken, for the result must always be negative. And that is actually what happened. The Pan-German representatives might have talked themselves hoarse, but to no effect whatsoever. The press either ignored them totally, or so mutilated their speeches that the logical consistency was destroyed, or the meaning twisted round in such a way that the public got only a very wrong impression regarding the aims of the new movement. What the individual members said was not of importance. The important matter was what people read as coming from them. This consisted of mere extracts, which had been torn out of the context of the speeches and gave an impression of incoherent nonsense, which indeed was purposely meant. Thus the only public before which they really spoke consisted merely of 500 parliamentarians, and that says enough. The worst was the following. The Pan-German movement could hope for success only if the leaders realized from the very first moment that here there was no question so much of a new party as of a new Weltanschauung. This alone could arouse the inner moral forces that were necessary for such a gigantic struggle. And for this struggle, the leaders must be men of first-class brains and indomitable courage. If the struggle on behalf of a Weltanschauung is not conducted by men of heroic spirit, who are ready to sacrifice everything, within a short while it will become impossible to find real fighting followers who are ready to lay down their lives for the cause. A man who fights only for his own existence has not much left over for the service of the community. In order to secure the conditions that are necessary for success, everybody concerned must be made to understand that the new movement looks to posterity for its honour and glory, but that it has no recompense to offer to the present-day members. If a movement should offer a large number of positions and offices that are easily accessible, the number of unworthy candidates admitted to membership will be constantly on the increase, and eventually a day will come when there will be such a preponderance of political profiteers among the membership of a successful party that the combatants who bore the brunt of the battle in the early stages of the movement can now scarcely recognize their own party, and may be ejected by the later arrivals as unwanted ballast. Therewith the movement will no longer have a mission to fulfill.
File 24.
Once the Pan-Germanists decided to collaborate with Parliament, they were no longer leaders and combatants in a popular movement, but merely parliamentarians. Thus the movement sank to the common political party level of the day, and no longer had the strength to face a hostile fate and defy the risk of martyrdom. Instead of fighting, the Pan-German leaders fell into the habit of talking and negotiating. The new parliamentarians soon found that it was a more satisfactory, because less risky, way of fulfilling their task if they would defend the new Weltanschauung with the spiritual weapon of parliamentary rhetoric rather than take up a fight in which they placed their lives in danger, the outcome of which also was uncertain, and even at the best could offer no prospect of personal gain for themselves. When they had taken their seats in Parliament, their adherents outside hoped and waited for miracles to happen. Naturally, no such miracles happened or could happen. Whereupon the adherents of the movement soon grew impatient, because reports they read about their own deputies did not in the least come up to what had been expected when they voted for these deputies at the elections. The reason for this was not far to seek. It was due to the fact that an unfriendly press refrained from giving a true account of what the Pan-German representatives of the people were actually doing. According as the new deputies got to like this mild form of revolutionary struggle in Parliament and in the provincial diets, they gradually became reluctant to resume the more hazardous work of expounding the principles of the movement before the broad masses of the people. Mass meetings in public became more and more rare, though these are the only means of exercising a really effective influence upon the people, because here the influence comes from direct personal contact. And in this way the support of large sections of the people can be obtained. When the tables on which the speakers used to stand in the great beer halls, addressing an assembly of thousands, were deserted for the parliamentary tribune, and the speeches were no longer addressed to the people directly, but to the so-called chosen representatives, the Pan-German movement lost its popular character, and in a little while degenerated to the level of a more or less serious club, where problems of the day are discussed academically. The wrong impression created by the press was no longer corrected by personal contact with the people through public meetings, whereby the individual representatives might have given a true account of their activities. The final result of this neglect was that the word Pan-German came to have an unpleasant sound in the ears of the masses. The knights of the pen and the literary snobs of today should be made to realize that the great transformations which have taken place in this world were never conducted by a goose quill. No, the task of the pen must always be that of presenting the theoretical concepts which motivate such changes. The force which has ever and always set in motion great historical avalanches of religious and political movements is the magic power of the spoken word. The broad masses of a population are more amenable to the appeal of rhetoric than to any other force. All great movements are popular movements. They are the volcanic eruptions of human passions and emotions, stirred into activity by the ruthless goddess of distress, or by the torch of the spoken word cast into the midst of the people. In no case have great movements been set afoot by the syrupy effusions of aesthetic litterateurs and drawing-room heroes. The doom of a nation can be averted only by a storm of glowing passion, but only those who are passionate themselves can arouse passion in others. It is only through the capacity for passionate feeling that chosen leaders can wield the power of the word, which, like hammer blows, will open the door to the hearts of the people. He who is not capable of passionate feeling and speech was never chosen by Providence to be the herald of its will. Therefore, a writer should stick to his ink bottle and busy himself with theoretical questions if he has the requisite ability and knowledge. He has not been born or chosen to be a leader. A movement which has great ends to achieve must carefully guard against the danger of losing contact with the masses of the people. Every problem encountered must be examined from this viewpoint first of all, and the decision to be made must always be in harmony with this principle. The movement must avoid everything which might lessen or weaken its power of influencing the masses, not from demagogical motives, but because of the simple fact that no great idea no matter how sublime and exalted it may appear, can be realized in practice without the effective power which resides in the popular masses. Stern reality alone must mark the way to the goal. To be unwilling to walk the road of hardship means only too often in this world the total renunciation of our aims and purposes, whether that renunciation be consciously willed or not. The moment the pan-German leaders, in virtue of their acceptance of the parliamentary principle, moved the centre of their activities away from the people and into Parliament, in that moment they sacrificed the result was the acceptance of the parliamentary policy, which had a similar effect in regard to the importance of the masses. If there had been a proper appreciation of the tremendous powers of endurance always shown by the masses in revolutionary movements, a different attitude towards the social problem would have been taken, and also a different policy in the matter of propaganda. Then the centre of gravity of the movement would not have been transferred to the Parliament, but would have remained in the workshops and in the streets. There was a third mistake, which also had its roots in the failure to understand the worth of the masses. The masses are first set in motion, along a definite direction, by men of superior talents. But then these masses, once in motion, are like a flywheel, inasmuch as they sustain the momentum and steady balance of the offensive. The policy of the pan-German leaders in deciding to carry through a difficult fight against the Catholic Church can be explained only by attributing it to an inadequate understanding of the spiritual character of the people. The reasons why the new party engaged in a violent campaign against Rome were as follows. As soon as the House of Habsburg had definitely decided to transform Austria into a Slav state, all sorts of means were adopted which seemed in any way serviceable for that purpose. The Habsburg rulers had no scruples of conscience about exploiting even religious institutions in the service of this new state idea. One of the many methods thus employed was the use of Czech parishes and their clergy as instruments for spreading Slav hegemony throughout Austria. This proceeding was carried out as follows. Parish priests of Czech nationality were appointed in purely German districts. Gradually but steadily pushing forward the interests of the Czech people before those of the Church, the parishes and their priests became generative cells in the process of de-Germanization. Unfortunately, the German-Austrian clergy completely failed to counter this procedure. Not only were they incapable of taking a similar initiative on the German side, but they showed themselves unable to meet the Czech offensive with adequate resistance. The German element was accordingly pushed backwards, slowly but steadily, through the perversion of religious belief for political ends on the one side, and the jack of proper resistance on the other side. Such were the tactics used in dealing with the smaller problems. But those used in dealing with the larger problems were not very different. The anti-German aims pursued by the Habsburgs, especially through the instrumentality of the higher clergy, did not meet with any vigorous resistance, while the clerical representatives of the German interests withdrew completely to the rear. The general impression created could not be other than that the Catholic clergy as such were grossly neglecting the rights of the German population. Therefore, it looked as if the Catholic Church was not in sympathy with the German people, but that it unjustly supported their adversaries. The root of the whole evil, especially according to Schirner's opinion, lay in the fact that the leadership of the Catholic Church was not in Germany, and that this fact